These are the top stories. Palestine says the UN has openly sided with Israel after the world body did not include the regime in its blacklist for violating children's rights. The Yemeni army releases the footage showing it has shot down a U.S. spy aircraft over the skies of Ma'are province. Also ahead, Brazil reports over 44,000 new coronavirus cases and more than 1,000 deaths in 24 hours, bringing its total fatalities to nearly 502,000. Palestine slams the UN decision not to include Israel in its blacklist of groups for violating children's rights, saying the world body has openly sided with the regime. In a statement, Palestinian Foreign Ministry said the UN's move would embolden the regime to continue committing organized terrorism and crimes against humanity. It added that the decision has undermined the UN credibility. The ministry called on the world body to add Israel to its blacklist, saying the regime has grossly violated children's rights. Last month, the Israeli regime launched a massive onslaught on the Gaza Strip, killing hundreds of civilians. 66 children, as well as dozens of women, were among those killed. Political commentator Sayed Zulfikar said the UN decision not to add Israel to its blacklist was in effect a green light to the regime to kill children with impunity.
Of course, it can be interpreted as a green light of impunity that they can go on. Now, let's not forget that in 2014, when there was a last massive attack on Gaza, 561 children were murdered by Israeli bombing, and nearly 3,000 were wounded and some permanently maimed. The United Nations wrote a report at the time which stigmatized and condemned Israel, and yet there was, at the same time, exactly in June when this report was presented to the Security Council, there was, in 2015, there was very heavy lobbying by the United States and its partner Israel among the member states not to put Israel on the list. You know that Saudi Arabia was on that list for having bombed children's hospitals and children's schools and buses in Yemen. And yet in 2020, a few months, exactly a year ago, Saudi Arabia was taken off the list of shame by very strong lobbying by the United States. So in fact, it's the United States that runs the show. It's they, through the financial blackmail, are able to get exactly what they want from the Security Council.
The Israeli army has targeted the Gaza Strip's infrastructure, including its main water treatment station. This contaminated Gaza's water resources with untreated sewage, putting at risk the health of nearly 2 million Palestinians in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shabit reports.
Israeli forces carried out a full-scale military offensive against the Gaza Strip, targeting civilian areas and infrastructure in a clear violation of international humanitarian law. During this attack, Israel damaged paved roads and other infrastructure, including Gaza sewage treatment stations and networks. 18 sewage water pumps were damaged, and Gaza central sewage treatment stations were unable to function as employees were unable to go to their workplace due to the intensity of the situation.
The Israeli regime destroyed most infrastructure in Gaza. Sewage treatment stations were among the targets of the Israeli regime, where one of our main stations was completely destroyed and the rest are partially damaged. Israeli airstrikes also damaged the electricity network that generates the treatment stations. This has polluted the sea with untreated sewage.
The Gaza Electricity Distribution Company recently announced that its power supply services will be intermittent due to the lack of fuel used to generate electricity caused by Israel's ban of entering fuel. With the limited capacity of power supply due to the Israeli airstrikes of electricity networks, sewage water is directly treated into the sea. As a result, nearly 2 million Palestinians in Gaza now face a serious public health emergency.
There is a huge damage in the electricity network of the Gaza Strip. Electricity turned into a problem for Gazans since 2006, when Israeli regime destroyed the only electricity plant. Since then, all aspects of our lives have been negatively impacted. The electricity condition is terrible due to the Israeli blockade that prevents entering fuel.
In Palestinian refugee camps, the condition is even worse, where residents of the camp are suffering the shortage of clean water and bad health conditions since the Israeli blockade was imposed for more than 15 years. This led to the increase of diseases among the residents.
This is a terrible condition here. We are left without water and electricity. We are stuck at home because Israel targets any moving thing. There isn't any water for drinking, cleaning, or any other purposes. Israel intends to target our infrastructure and the water station as a punishment for all Gazans.
In addition to the Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip for about 15 years, the continuous violence against civilians and infrastructure has increased the suffering of 2 million Palestinians and undermined their rights of living and health. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The Yemeni army has released footage showing its downing of a U.S. spy drone over the province of Ma'arib. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the drone, known as Scan Eagle, was spotted and hit while flying over Mashjah region. He added that the UAV was brought down using a land-to-air missile. The spokesman also underlined that the Yemeni armed forces would not hold back any efforts to defend the country's skies against aggressive activities. Well, two civilians are killed and seven wounded in fresh Saudi strikes on Yemen. Casualties were the result of Saudi artillery attacks on a border area in Sa'ada province. Recent attacks came on the heels of retaliatory strikes by the Yemeni army on an airbase inside Saudi Arabia. Riyadh launched a war on Yemen in 2015 with the aim of reinstating a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have stepped up their retaliatory attacks against the kingdom in recent months. They have been pushing for the lifting of a blockade on Yemen and an end to the war that has killed tens of thousands of people. Our correspondent in Sana'a says the Saudi regime launches attacks on Yemeni civilians almost on a daily basis.
These attacks are almost on a daily basis. Hundreds of civilians, including women and children, were killed with the artillery attacks of the Saudi army. This is another aspect of the Saudi war on Yemeni people. These attacks have never achieved any military purpose for the Saudi army. All the victims and the casualties are civilians. This is also an indicator that the recent talks and the recent negotiations have failed. Unfortunately, the Omani delegation couldn't achieve anything, couldn't push the political process. So I believe that the Yemeni army will respond to the attacks on the Yemenis and will launch larger and wider attacks on Saudi facilities, on Saudi military sites, and also vital facilities, and especially Aramco will be the main target for the Yemeni army.
Talks in Vienna aimed at reviving Iran's nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA, have adjourned, and the delegates have headed back home for a short break. Iran's lead negotiator says a deal is closer than ever before. Homa Lezgi explains.
The sixth round of talks to revive the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA comes to an end in Vienna. Delegates are headed back home for a short break, this time not for further consultations, says Iran's lead delegate, but for decision-making.
We are closer to a deal than any time in the past. but it doesn't mean that we are there. The remaining job is still difficult and needs lots of, you know, efforts and you know, further talks. So we decided to cut negotiations here, go back home, not only for consultations, but this time for decision making.
The U.S. administration, represented by Robert Malley, has talked of a longer and stronger deal, but Iran has made it clear it will only agree to the restoration of the original JCPOA, a position reiterated by Russia.
It was agreed from the very beginning our aim was to restore the JCPOA in its original form, nothing more and nothing less. So if you are talking about follow-on talks, it's something like JCPOA plus. And she actually, for example, the issues of regional security in the Persian Gulf is a separate topic.
Iran is still demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions, including those imposed additionally under former President Donald Trump after his withdrawal from the deal in 2018. Iran says it would only come back to full compliance after it can verify sanctions removal. It's also seeking guarantees the U.S. will not withdraw from the agreement again. Without such an assurance, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says a return to the JCPOA will not be possible. Up until now, the U.S. has shown no signs it's willing to give that assurance. If a deal is to be reached in the next round or by mid-July, the right political decisions need to be made. Homolezki, Vienna.
Brazil has recorded over 44,000 new COVID-19 infections and more than 1,000 deaths from the respiratory disease. Latest health ministry data put the country's total cases at 17.9 million. The figures have also raised the country's overall coronavirus fatalities to nearly 502,000. Brazil has witnessed the world's third worst outbreak and the second deadliest following that of the U.S. President Jair Bolsonaro has come under fire for his handling of the COVID-19 crisis. Political activist Bruno Bicolini says the Brazilian leadership is to blame for the country's COVID-19 crisis. Take a listen.
What is happening here is that part of the mainstream media, the left, the center-left, and part of the civil society is very upset with Bolsonaro because he's still a denialist. And he's still making jokes against the vaccine. So the spread of the disease in Brazil is totally responsible for Bolsonaro's irresponsible policies on health, I would say unhealth policies, delaying the demands of the vaccine, not negotiating with Pfizer, for example, and not negotiating with CoronaVac because of the consortium between the São Paulo state government and the China state government. It's a total disaster here, I would say so.
India has registered its lowest daily coronavirus cases in nearly 3 months. The country reported more than 58,000 new COVID-19 infections in the past 24 hours, bringing the total caseload to 29.9 million. The overall fatalities hover around 387,000. The new daily infections in India dropped recently after a surge in April and May. Daily infections reached their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the surge. The country now has the second largest caseload and the third highest death toll in the world. Our New Delhi-based correspondent Munawar Zaman says the recent decline in coronavirus cases in India is encouraging signs, but health experts warn a third wave is inevitable.
The cases have started dropping significantly since last 2 weeks. And if we remember, in April, there was an utter mayhem across the country. The new cases have declined in a tremendous way. And the death toll has also declined, which is showing some signs of joy for the country's people. And the country has started opening up, which means there is more economic activity and people can start going to work. And at the same time, people feel this is a new life because the lockdowns has devastated the livelihood of millions across India, and a lot of people are facing facing acute poverty and at the same time problems of unemployment. Well, now the biggest challenge here in India is that many health experts and scientists are warning that the third wave is inevitable and it is very close, approximately 4 to 6 weeks away. And they're warning people that they should not take things lightly.
Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan has claimed victory in the country's highly contested parliamentary elections. In a speech, Pashinyan said the people of Armenia gave him and his civil contract party a mandate to lead the country. The Premier's party has managed to garner 58% of the votes, while the Armenia Alliance, led by former President Robert Kocharyan, has only secured nearly 19% with 47% of ballots counted. Kocharyan has challenged the results, saying he does not recognize Pashinyan's victory claim. The election was held following the government's call for a snap vote to end a political crisis. The deadlock was reached over Armenia losing a deadly war against Azerbaijan last year and ceding territory in and around the Nagorno-Karabakh region. The U.S. is planning to impose new sanctions on Russia over the alleged poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the White House is preparing a package of embargoes in the case. This will be the second time Washington has sanctioned Russia over the incident. Back in March, 7 senior Russian government officials and 14 entities were blacklisted over the alleged poisoning. In August of last year, Navalny fell ill on board a return flight from Siberia to Moscow, and the plane made an emergency landing in Tomsk. Later, he was airlifted to Germany for medical treatment, where he spent months to recover. The U.S. and some Western countries claim Navalny had been poisoned by the Russian government. The Kremlin has denied any involvement in his illness. And that's it with international news.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
Federal meteorologists and climate experts say the potential for another devastating wildfire season is higher than normal for much of the western United States, where a brutal heat wave has shattered temperature records across multiple states. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading, 33 Wildfires Are Already Burning Across 10 U.S. States. Stay tuned for more. Federal meteorologists and climate experts say the potential for another devastating wildfire season is higher than normal for much of the western United States, where a brutal heat wave shattered temperature records across multiple states recently. Nearly 90% of the West is experiencing drought, increasing the amount of fuel for fires, such as dead trees and brush that is drawing out up to a month ahead of schedule in many places, according to the latest climate update from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. The past spring has been the warmest on record and the driest since 2006 in the lower 48 states. Drought conditions have only intensified during the latest heat wave. More than 40 million people experienced triple-digit temperatures recently, straining power grids in Texas and California and prompting officials across the Southwest to warn the public against walking dogs on hot sidewalks and spending time outside during the day. Wildfires are already burning across multiple states, including a massive 21,000-acre blaze in Montana, according to the U.S. Forest Service and news reports. With the start of summer right around the corner, the National Interagency Fire Center reported 5 new large fires recently, bringing the current total to 33 fires burning across more than 400,000 acres in 10 western states. Wildfires occur naturally and play an important role in certain ecosystems, especially in the West. However, climate change and disruption of natural areas caused by human pollution and development have created conditions for widespread and devastatingly intense wildfires. A landmark 2016 study found that human-caused climate change is responsible for 55% of the increase in dryness that creates fuel for wildfires, more than doubling the amount of land burned across the western U.S. over the past three decades. Last year, record-breaking summer temperatures, the fourth highest level of drought on record, an unusual amount of dry lightning combined to create apocalyptic fire season that saw 10.27 million acres of land burned, the most ever recorded according to Yale Climate Conditions. Millions of people in California, Oregon, and Washington were forced to evacuate from cities large and small as huge wildfires raced across landscape and sent enough smoke into the air to change atmospheric conditions across the nation. Gina Palma, a fire meteorologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, said scientists are currently observing drought conditions that they would not normally see, not in June, especially in the foothills of mountains and higher elevations across the West, increasing the likelihood of fires. Still, every fire needs a spark, and it remains to be seen whether lightning or fires started by people, for example, will spark the tinder available in brushy areas and dry forests and cause another intense wildfire season. While there are a number of factors behind these tinderbox conditions, human-caused climate change is certainly one of them. We do expect in a warmer world to see more frequent and more intense wildfires and also heat waves, Palma told reporters recently. There is some good news. NOAA forecasters predict monsoon rains that were largely absent in recent years will return to New Mexico and Arizona later in the summer, relieving drought conditions and reducing the potential for significant wildfire outbreaks to normal levels. Palma said widespread drought has also prevented grass from growing that could dry out later in the summer and provide fuel for potential fires. The potential for fire across most of Texas and Midwest is expected to be normal or below normal this summer, although scientists warn that normal summer conditions could soon be a thing of the past, as climate change threatens to become irreversible absent a widespread reduction in fossil fuel pollution. According to NOAA, it's still highly likely that many of the same areas across California, Utah, Oregon, Idaho, Washington, and western Montana that suffered destructive and even deadly wildfires last year will see significant wildfire activity this summer.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss issues and questions regarding the Islamic upbringing of our children, because our children are our future. And to help us with our issues, we have Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi with us, the always blissful Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for being with us.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Okay, so Sayyid Abdullah, we began the last episode talking about the methods related to the upbringing of our children. We're trying to have a positive upbringing. That is the keyword of our show. And up to now, we've talked about accepting that this is our responsibility. It's not someone else's job. And secondly, understanding that the best method is to fix ourselves in order so that our children can be better reflections, much better reflections of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We explained that, so we have a first step and the foundations that is us. And so what we're trying to do now is that for them to become much better than us. In last episode, we talked about finding out our problems and issues and mistakes and trying to fix them. But what about the good things that we have? Like, some people might be very good at smiling or might be very honest and things like that. Would it be inappropriate for someone to go after the good things about themselves and try to also transfer that to their children? I mean, would it be against humbleness?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد وعجل فرجهم. Okay, just so we make few things clear, that we're trying to go through the process of making a better child, right? So we still, like, I mean, we haven't gone through the methods yet. So now we're talking pretty much about the intro to the methods.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the prerequisites to
okay.
the methods. So inshallah, we'll talk about the methods one by one and what we can apply. So just keep that in mind.
We'll talk about all of this extensively.
Yeah, so inshallah, we'll talk about them. But just so you can have that, because sometimes we keep mentioning the word methods, but we actually have not spoken about the methods yet, right?
Okay.
So all this talk, we're trying to clear the way, clear the path, so inshallah we could get to the methods one by one that parents could apply in their life and to their kids' upbringing. So when we said that a parent needs to get rid of the negative and have the positive things, when it's a matter of teaching, all the concept of, you know, shawaf and riya and everything falls off. I mean, these things, like, for example, like what you said, if you do it to the outside world, to people, just to show off, obviously we have a problem, right? That self-showing off is a problem, or riya is a problem. But if you're doing it, for example, smiling, like you mentioned smiling, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he said, التبسم صدقة, right? Smiling is a charity. Even if you don't feel like smiling, even if you don't want to smile, smile for free. It's a charity itself, right? So teach yourself that habit. Not just saying, okay, I'm going to smile just to show off, to do riya. No one would do that. You know what I mean?
I'm thinking of that, like, person think that I'm now going to raise
it doesn't
this
go against
muscle.
No. So it doesn't go against being humble and stuff like that. No, it's actually on the contrary. When you do nice things on the outside, it becomes a habit that you do always, and it's a good habit. You know what I mean? So it's not going to collide with the concept of riya or the concept of, you know, being humble and so on and so forth. It's not going to clash. But when it comes with our kids, like I said, we have to put up even a show just so they can learn from us.
Okay, great. I think that's a great place to stop. A golden sentence. Sometimes we have to put up a show just to teach our children something. We're going to take a break now, but after the break, we'll be back to continue about the prerequisites of a positive upbringing. Don't go away.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about a positive upbringing of our children. So Sayyid Abdullah, we said that there are a few prerequisites. The first one is accepting responsibility, that this is our job to raise this child. The second is to fix our own problems in order to raise our children correctly. We cannot expect them not to inherit our problems, or for us to keep up, like, for instance, if we're this chronic liar, for them not to turn into chronic liars as well. What is the third prerequisite in a positive upbringing?
The third one we have to mention and end with, so we can move on, because I think the more we keep talking, the more we drift away from the topic, is that the parents need to understand that their child forms a shape and it gets sculptured into a human being around the first 8 years of his life. So 90%, they say, according to psychologists, 90% of who the child is when he grows up is made in the first 8 years. So imagine if you have mud and you're trying to make a sculpture, or you make a figure out of mud. This is the years that you put the shapes in. And if you notice that most of the problems that adults suffer from, like when it comes to their morals, when it comes to their upbringing, when it comes to their ethics, what they lack, if you go to the source of it, you'll find that when they were in the first 8 years, something went wrong. That shows up back. So, for example, when you look at, I'm talking statistically here, so for example, when they look at people who are thieves, those who steal, or rapists, or murderers, they say, well, most of the times when they were kids, they either lived in a violent family, or either they lived in a family where, for example, one of the parents is not available, either they're orphaned or, you know, through divorce. All things went wrong in that period of their life, that it just made such a trauma into them that as they grew older, they just don't care anymore. So they would steal, they would kill, they would rape, they would do all crimes. So it all goes back to what? To these first 8 years. So as parents, we have to put a great emphasis in this, you know, first 8 years of their life. We have to take that extremely seriously, because sometimes we do the absolutely opposite. We say, you know what, they're just kids, leave them. No. So in a hadith from Imam Sallallahu Alaihi, which we use as a golden rule when it comes to upbringing, it says, اتركوهم سبعا, ادبوهم سبعا, صاحبوهم سبعا, right? So leave them for seven, tease them for seven, and befriend them seven. So when we say leave them for seven, we're not saying just let them be whatever they want.
Abandon them.
It's a teach them, but teaching, what kind of teaching? So the Imam says first 7 years, there's no teaching. The second seven is a teaching process. In the first seven, what we do is we bring them up and we teach them through example. Like we embed the good akhlaq, the good morals, the good ethics into them without enforcing it as in a teaching way. And the other seven, no, I sit the child down, I said to him, this is halal, this is haram, this is you should do, this is you should not do. So it becomes more of an enforce. But that
stringent.
Comes what? I'll give you an example. For example, we say girls need to wear a hijab at the age of 9. So what we do is, like, 2 years before, we make her wear the hijab. Just, you know, out of habit, but we don't enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
We say, you know, wear it, it's nice, it's good, you know, we encourage it. But that's, it's not a teaching. After 9, we say, no, darling, you have to wear it.
Becomes strict.
You have to wear it. And we teach her why you have to wear it. You know what I mean? So the first 8 years is vital in programming the child.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop you there for a late break, but we'll be back. Don't go away.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, when a child becomes intellectually mature and is able to recite parts of the Quran, he should be taught how to pray.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the prerequisites to a proper Islamic upbringing. We said accepting responsibility, fixing your own issues, and now knowing that, taking notice that ages 0 to 8 are the most important. It's actually the time where you have to raise your children.
Mm.
But are we talking, when we're saying 0 to 8, are we literally talking 0? Like, how about the first few months? Because how much is there for a child to learn in the first few months, I mean, regarding morality and self-confidence and things like that?
Well, if we have to look at it from an Islamic perspective, Islam goes even beyond the child, beyond the
before
birth
zero.
Before zero, before the birth of the
yeah.
child. See, when the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, اختاروا لنطفكم فان الارق دساس, he said, choose for your kids. You know, the right, because you know, al-irq, if we translate it, is DNA. Is that DNA could be a treacherous thing, right? Because you don't know what's going to come, so you have to choose the right mother, right? Because the right mother from the right family would have what, the right DNA, which means that DNA itself, even scientists they say it carries traits. It carries traits like bravery, generosity, and so on and so on. It carries traits. And that's why Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he wanted to, after Fatima Zahra, he wanted to get married, he wanted his brother Aqil, he said to him, اختار لي امرأة أولدتها الفحول من العرب. Choose a woman for me that was being given birth by the
the warriors of the Arabs.
Why? So he wants a woman that actually carries the genes of bravery in her, and gave you Al-Abbas alayhi salam. So this is what, when we talk, we're not going to zero. We have to go from the beginning if we want to be precise.
Okay.
So if we want to be precise, we got before zero.
But now, I mean, like, in the first few months, a child is mostly discovering what an object is, the rules of physics and stuff like what things taste like. I mean, are we literally saying that there are things that parents can do at that age that will affect their future?
Can, of course. Mm-hmm. And this has been proven even on the field. For example, you go on YouTube and you see a lot of clips of parents who teach their kids at a very young age, like even a month old, few months old. They teach them a few things, either through the process of making them listen to music. They put headphones on them or music surrounding them, or they make certain sounds, or they have, I've seen a lot of kids with card tricks. Like they show them cards and the child interact to the cards and they can tell what's in the cards. So the child himself, his brain is fully working, it's fully functioning. And at that age, it's a sponge, right? It just absorbs everything. That's why it is absolutely ready for teaching and learning.
Mm-hmm.
So this age, he might be young, but his brain is fully wide, fully open, and he's observing everything inside.
So heads up, folks, we're talking literally from 0 to 8, and we will cover all of this in our future episodes. We're just taking a broad overlook of what you have and the prerequisites, basically, until we get to the methods. That's all the time that we have, unfortunately. If you missed it, don't worry, you can always download an archive of this episode and all our previous episodes from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com. Find the link of Call of Islam Radio and you'll find our show right there with all the episodes ready for downloading. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. And find us on social media. Simply search at Call of Islam Radio on Twitter, Instagram, Telegram, and YouTube. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life. A way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
Nasser Gandil, a senior Lebanese journalist, says the lively popular participation in Iran's presidential elections clearly bore witness to the deep-running connection between the country's people and its Islamic establishment. We now present you an article authored by Sayed Zafar Mehdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor, and blogger with over 10 years' experience, who has reported exclusively from Kashmir, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran for leading publications worldwide. The piece is titled Iranians Defeat Rabble-Rousers with Ballots, Uphold Democracy. Please stay with us for more of Sayed Zafar Mahdi's article. Amidst the cacophony of foreign-backed propaganda and misinformation crusade aimed at derailing Iran's vibrant democratic politics, people and the Republic again emerged as winners on Friday, 18th of June. The nefarious schemes of arrogant powers were yet again thwarted by the proud nation of Iran, by all those who participated in Friday's presidential election and voted for democracy. The most fitting answer to rabble-rousers is the ballot, a powerful and potent weapon in the hands of ordinary people. It's the catalyst of political and social change. Not all people can use this weapon, and not all understand its sanctity. Some of them, ironically, never miss a chance to vilify Iran and its democratic institutions. We don't need to go too far. In Iran's neighborhood, there are people who have never seen a ballot box, never known what democracy smells like, with lifelong autocrats taking decisions for them. On the other hand, there are also so-called democracies where political elites and their unruly supporters refuse to accept people's verdict and go on to attack the so-called symbols of democracy. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, based on the sacrosanct teachings of Islam and the cherished principles of democracy, people are empowered to elect their representatives, who are answerable to them. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said in his very enlightening congratulatory message on Saturday, 19th of June, the victory in Friday's vote belongs to the Iranian nation. He said the people again stood up to the propaganda of enemies' mercenary media and deceptions of ill-wishers, showing their presence in the heart of the country's political arena. There are legitimate grievances related to economic problems and difficult living conditions resulting from it. Enemies have tried to exploit these fault lines, pitting people against the government. But who is responsible for this situation? Those who have imposed crippling sanctions on the Islamic Republic, denying access even to life-saving medicines, or the country's frozen assets abroad. The brave and resilient people of Iran, who have, with unwavering determination, resisted economic terrorism of the West for many years, understand this. They can deconstruct these schemes. Friday's vote was against all those arrogant, murderous forces that have been hell-bent on bringing Iranians to their knees through maximum pressure and economic terrorism. The vote was an answer to those who gave cause of election boycott, including some paid social media mercenaries who peddled lies to dissuade young voters from participating in the election. The writing is on the wall. The proud nation of Iran is here to stay because it derives its power from the people, and can distinguish between ballot boxes and fruit boxes to invoke the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Friday's election also showed political astuteness of the country's electorate, which voted principalists back to power after 8 years of Hassan Rouhani-led reformist government. People gave their mandate to Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, a top principalist figure, while rejecting his main reformist challenger and former top banker, Abdel Nasser Hemati, on Friday, because they wanted change in the status quo. More importantly, they were empowered to do so. The lone reformist candidate in the presidential race, who served as the top banker in Hassan Rouhani's administration, had sought to distance himself from the government, but people cannot be taken for granted. The election result is a testament to Iran's vibrant democracy, where conscientious, intelligent, and smart voters cast their ballots based on plans and manifestos of the candidates, rather than sloganeering. The lively presidential debates in the run-up to last Friday's election showed how important the electorate is for candidates in this country. There were heated arguments too, but no expletives or name-calling happened, as we saw in the US election recently. The focus must not be lost. The idea is to win the trust and the faith of the people, an alien concept in many Western democracies. Unlike the West, where big corporations and big corporate houses, powerful political lobbies and money influence the outcome of elections, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, it is the people who determine the outcome of the elections. Another important feature that distinguishes Iran's democratic politics is the smooth transition of power and the grace with which presidents hand over power. It was again seen on Saturday, 19th of June, moments after preliminary results showed that Ebrahim Raisi winning by a massive margin, when President Hassan Rouhani became the first person to visit Raisi. The two political rivals addressed media together, with both showing class and grace. Compare that with the United States, where the outgoing president, Donald Trump, doesn't even show up at the incoming president, Joe Biden's swearing-in ceremony, making mockery of the so-called democracy. Then, with lack of ideas to show Iran in poor light, hue and cries raised over disqualification of certain candidates, without understanding the nitty-gritty of the issue. The Guardian Council is a constitutionally mandated body tasked with vetting of the candidates for elections, and it operates strictly on legal parameters. It's not a kangaroo court that operates on whims and fancies, as we see in many countries that proudly call themselves U.S. allies. Vetting of candidates is a painstaking process that takes days and marathon sessions of brainstorming discussions between experts, taking into consideration eligibility criteria and national interests. And the law of the land is supreme everywhere. So the entire hullabaloo over it is wholly unwarranted. But what is clear is the hostility towards Iran, which shows clearly that Iran is definitely doing something right to ruffle the feathers of its enemies. Senior Lebanese journalist says the lively popular participation in Iran's presidential elections clearly bore witness to the deep-running connection between the country's people and its Islamic establishment. Nasser Gandil, editor-in-chief of Lebanon's Al-Bina newspaper, made the remark in an interview with Press TV on Saturday, 19th of June. The country's opponents began portraying a very gloomy picture of the Poles to discourage popular contribution inside and outside of the country. However, amid the incessant attacks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, put out a clear message, inviting all Iranians to stage a zealous participation in the event, therefore frustrating the country's enemies. Qandil described the exact areas where the malicious anti-Iran campaign had failed after a public heeded Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's clarion call. He remained below the public reception, prompted the officials to extend the time limit on the election several times, with the polls remaining open well past midnight. Nasser Qandil noted, this took the same foreign media outlets by surprise and had them confess to the magnitude of the popular participation in the presidential election. The experts said the sabotage campaign failed to prove that the U.S.-led economic warfare against Iran had succeeded in turning the people away from the polls. Washington has been using sanctions as its weapon of choice in the war, preventing Iran from buying even its basic necessities and blocking the country's access to its overseas financial resources. He added, the Iranian people showed that their independence is not up for sale. They have seen what has become of the countries that have chosen to depend on the West, thus selling their independence and getting stuck in a quagmire of debt. Despite increasing crises, Iranians are aware of their country's great position and know that these crises are meant to act as means of breaking their willpower. Iranians have realized that the cost of resistance is far less than the cost carried by surrender, and that resistance opens up many options and opportunities for them. Iranians showed that sanctions would not change their choices, and the ones who have to change are those who are imposing the sanctions.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.